also supported by the Indian Residential School Survivor Society and is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To hear more, go to www.ncra.ca/resonating.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, all listeners to Amandla Radio here at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We are here tonight with quite an interesting lineup. Gwen, what have you got on the go?
Yes, indeed. Okay, we do have quite the nice lineup. So we're going to be kicking off the show with an interview that I did with Catherine Cummins, who's research coordinator at Mining Watch Canada. And as our listeners will recall, she and I spoke really recently about Barrick Gold and its mine in North Mara in Tanzania. That conversation was about how 3 years ago, Barrick Gold took over full control of that mine, a mine that has been dogged by a terrible history of human rights abuses and environmental abuses. Barrick took full control, saying that they were going to put an end to that. And what Mining Watch Canada discovered recently in field research that they did there was that it's actually quite the contrary, that the situation continues to be abysmal with ongoing violence against members of the community in North Mara. So that's what we talked about a few weeks ago. And then, you know, lo and behold, a couple of days after that interview, it hits the headlines that 21 people from North Mara are filing suit against Barrick Gold for these human rights abuses, and it's in a Canadian court. So this is big news, and I was able to get Catherine to come back onto Amandla to talk about that. So we're going to do that in the first part of the show. That will be followed by Amandla Sama, Sama's been keeping her eye on COP13 here in Montreal, and she spoke with Dr. Evan Kariga, who is an Kenyan anthropologist who looks at the intersection of biodiversity and livelihoods for Indigenous communities in Kenya, and more specifically, the Maasai Mara. And then we'll be kicking off with Sama, who has been keeping a close eye on the COP13 conference here in Montreal, and she interviewed Kenyan anthropologist Dr. Evan Kariga on the intersection of biodiversity and livelihoods of Indigenous communities in Kenya. Then the Sama wraps up with a nice little piece on what else, but of course, Morocco, and how proud and impressed we are.
Already, Africa,
World Cup. So that's our lineup for today. And speaking of Morocco, Doug, you've pulled out some special music.
Well, it's amazing how the crowd everywhere have come behind Morocco, the underdog. Nobody would have ever expected an African team to get to the semifinals, let alone the possibility of the finals. And so I chose some Maghrebian music. Des Orientales is one of my favorite groups, a fusion group of North African musicians in Paris. And their first song is Maghreb One. And then I'm going to play No Made in France. Nya, 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 France. And finally, I found a really neat piece by a group called Krabata from Morocco, called Dabasafi, a cute little two or three minute piece with a couple of young boys walking around with their soccer ball, visiting granny and stuff. Ooh, it's really quite
nice.
Cute. It's called Dabasafi by Krabata. So stay tuned to Amandla.
Welcome back to Amanda here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CKUT.ca around the world. And we're not talking about our website right now because we're in a major reconstruction of it, but hopefully it will be up running soon and will feature the best of Amanda. So as I said in the introduction, I had the great, Catherine Cummins of Mining Watch Canada very graciously agreed to come back and speak to Amanda again, this time about the lawsuit that has been launched against Barrick Gold, the second biggest gold mining company in the world, a Canadian company. 21 Tanzanians from North Mara have filed suit in a Canadian court against this Goliath. And here's Catherine Cummins just bringing us in on the details of that. Catherine, welcome back to Amanda. We actually spoke very recently because Mining Watch had just issued a report. He was murdered, violence against Kuria High after Barrick takeover of mine. And in essence, what that report talked about was the ongoing violence in North Mara, in Tanzania, perpetrated by police and security forces that are paid by Barrick Gold to protect the mine. And the people in the surrounding community are often the target of this violence with very little redress. So in essence, that's what you and I talked about a few weeks ago. Lo and behold, we end that interview and a couple of days later, it hits the headlines that Barrick Gold is being sued by some of the members of this community in a Canadian court. So this is huge news. Canadian mining company, second biggest gold mining company in the world. And this group of people is taking on this giant. So could you tell us a little bit about the plaintiffs?
Yeah, so the plaintiffs are really reflective of the kinds of people that Mining Watch Canada has been interviewing, community members of the local Indigenous Kuria communities around the mine and around the waste dumps and the pits of the mine. We've been interviewing people who have been targeted by mine security and police guarding the mine on behalf of Barrick since 2014. And these plaintiffs are very much reflective of the kinds of injuries and impacts that we've seen in the people that we've interviewed since 2014. So they're people who've been killed, shot to death or beaten to death. We've interviewed people who've been egregiously wounded, maimed in ways that will affect them for the rest of their lives. And of course, we've interviewed a lot of family members of those who've been either wounded or killed. And that's very much reflective of these plaintiffs.
Okay, so there are 21 plaintiffs in this case. Are they representing people who have either been killed or injured, or are they themselves direct victims of the violence? Tell us a little bit about the group themselves.
Yeah, so five of the plaintiffs are being represented by their family members because they are people who've been killed by being shot by mine police. And the other plaintiffs are representing themselves, and they are people who've either been severely beaten or shot and survived the shooting, but are now maimed and affected for life. And I just wanted to say something briefly about these beatings, because the beatings are really severe. The people that we've interviewed since 2014, and we've been going back and forth to this mine for seven times in those years, the beating victims that we've interviewed have really egregious injuries. Very often they're beaten around the head and they have neurological injuries, so speech impediments and movement impediments, and they also get beaten around their joints. So very often their knees, so that they can't walk. Sometimes also internal organs are affected. So these are really severe beatings. And then, of course, there's other plaintiffs that are people who've been shot and have survived. But again, you know, these are injuries that are really egregious. And we've also interviewed people who've had numerous incidents, who've been shot on one occasion, beaten on another occasion, and survived. And that, again, is also reflected in these plaintiffs. The other thing that's really reflected in these plaintiffs that we've also, you know, had in our interviews that we've done is people who have been shot from behind. So these are people who are actually fleeing. They're trying to get out of the way of the police or out of the mine site area, if that's where they are. So they've been shot from behind as they're fleeing. And also, we've interviewed quite a few people who have been shot who are innocent bystanders, who are villagers who are in their villages. But as the police are chasing people, they chase them into the villages through, you know, common roads, and they're shooting and people get shot just as innocent bystanders. And that's also reflected in these plaintiffs.
Catherine, for our listeners who didn't hear your and my conversation of a few weeks ago, I think it's worth talking a little bit about why these folks in Tanzania are being chased and shot. And, you know, essentially it comes down to the waste rock. So essentially and absurdly, the garbage, the rock that Barrick has thrown out as having trace amounts of gold, but not worth their economic while to continue to mine it. And it is this rock that members of the community are trying to mine for those trace amounts of gold, right? Like, is that essentially what this conflict is about?
Yes, that's a large part of it. So the indigenous Kuria that used to inhabit this area, but have been pushed out of their lands by the mine, are primarily cattle herders. But they were also small-scale in non-industrial miners. So the gold is very often very close to the surface. So they could mine a little bit of gold, and that was like a supplement to their income. When the mine came in, they lost their land. They don't have the land for agriculture. They don't have the land for their herds, which need to be able to roam over quite large areas, because this is a very arid region. And so what they have discovered is that in the waste rock, so this is the rock that the company is throwing out that has no economic value to the company, and if anything, it's going to cost them money to clean this up later. They're going into these waste rock piles, and they've discovered that there's residual trace amounts of gold, and it's enough to be worth their while to go in and to actually find those rocks that have that little bit of gold and process that gold, and it's a supplement to their income. And that's where most of these people are being targeted.
All right. So now they're taking Barrick Gold to court, which is a big deal. Barrick is a very powerful, litigious company. Can you tell us a little bit about what led them to make this decision? This is a commitment that could go on for years. It's expensive. Tell us a little bit about that process.
Yeah, you're right. I don't think legal action is necessarily the first or even the best course of action for access to remedy for the harm that people have endured. I think if there was a functioning, effective grievance mechanism, which Barrick is supposed to have at this mine, so that people could take their complaints there and receive effective remedy for the harm that they've endured, then they would probably prefer that. But in fact, Barrick's so-called grievance mechanism is completely non-functional. There's just nothing happening there. People are still bringing complaints there, but they get no response at all. So they really don't have another option other than to go to court. And, you know, it's just unbelievable. But the reality of this mine is that these issues, these human rights abuses, excess use of force by mine security has been going on for at least since 2011, when some of the earlier reports came out. And there's been two other lawsuits already on the exact same issues. So the first lawsuit was filed in 2013 and was settled out of court in 2015. Mining Watch started recording these injuries and these abuses in 2014. And some of the cases that Mining Watch recorded ended up in another lawsuit that was filed in 2020. These two lawsuits were both filed in the UK. The 2020 lawsuit is still ongoing. So that's two lawsuits. And then in September 2019, Barrick took over control of the mine. So Barrick now owns the entire ownership of the mine, except for 16%, which Barrick put in the hands of the Tanzanian government. And from that time on, it became possible, if there were additional cases, which unfortunately there are, always are, Barrick could be sued in Canada. And so that's why this lawsuit has now been filed in Canada. But it's been filed on behalf of these plaintiffs, but there's still the ongoing lawsuit in the UK that was filed in 2020. And you know, it's just shocking that there's now been three lawsuits on the same issues, all within the time period that Barrick was involved with this mine. and had a majority ownership all throughout, and yet this keeps happening. And in fact, there was another killing by mine security, by mine police, just on November 30th. So right after this case was filed, there's been another killing. So it really does beg the question, what will it take for Barrick to take action to actually stop the killing instead of just litigating these cases, over and over again?
They definitely have deeper pockets than the villagers of North Mara, so they can probably afford to this strategy doesn't hurt them as much as it may hurt the pocketbooks of some of the poorest people in the world who are taking this company on. But it does beg the next question, I guess, which is, maybe does it make a difference that this time the lawsuit is in Canada? This is a Canadian mining company. This company has a lot of political capital and power in Canada. So is there sort of a qualitative difference in the fact that it is being tried on its own home turf, do you think?
I think it's important. I think it's really important. I'm really glad that it was now possible to actually have this case filed in Canada. I think, if nothing else, there's a reputational issue around this. But it's also a matter of holding our own government to account. So Barrick Gold has always received a lot of political support in Canada. And so just to think about the North Mara mine, and Mining Watch has been reporting and publishing on these human rights abuses, this excess use of force by mine security, and the egregious harm that has come to the Korea people since 2014. We have included the Canadian embassy in those reports. So Canada has a high commission actually in Tanzania. We've met with the high commission. They are aware of our reports. We've done access to information. We have seen that they're aware of our reports. They have never reached out to us to say, wow, this is a real problem. We really need to talk to you. Like, tell us more about this. They've never reached out to us. When we've reached out to them, they've been very closed-mouthed about the support that they're providing the company. We don't know if the company has signed an integrity agreement, which is something that embassies require companies to sign in order to give them political support. They won't tell us whether Barrick has signed this agreement. Informally, we've been told, this was back when we met with them, I think it was 2017, that they had not. But they are receiving, and they have received, it's very overt that they've received political support through the High Commission in Dar es Salaam. So, I think the Canadian government also has a responsibility here to look at, when it's providing support to companies like Barrick, what is the actual track record? What are the allegations that are being brought, and how is the government dealing with those? And what we really want in Canada, and what we're advocating for, is something called mandatory human rights and environmental due diligence. This would be, we think, legislation that has been tabled. So there is draft legislation that has been tabled in a bill 262. If that bill were to be passed, we think that that would have a preventative working on these kinds of cases. So we're also really calling on the Canadian government at this time to implement mandatory environmental and human rights due diligence legislation.
And do you think that by virtue of the fact that this case is now being pursued in Canada, that could represent some added pressure on the government to be more responsive to these concerns?
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I mean, we certainly will make it so. We will certainly be bringing this case up again and again in our meetings with civil servants and with members of parliament, and certainly within members of parliament with the Liberals. We know that they're considering corporate accountability legislation. We know that what they're considering is not going to be effective and certainly would not address the issues of the killings and the maimings and the beatings and North Mara that go on and on and on. We need mandatory human rights and environmental due diligence legislation to really, I think, address this issue. And so we will be bringing this up in our meetings, political meetings here and lobbying here in Ottawa for sure.
I guess presumably also it's going to raise greater Canadian awareness of what's going on in Tanzania. I think that was the case when another Canadian mining company, Nevsun, was up to some pretty poor practices in Eritrea. Canadians, for the first time, were hearing about that because the court case was held here in Canada. So, possibly.
Exactly. And there's now been seven other cases against Canadian mining companies that have been filed in Canada. So I think, you know, the evidence is mounting that Canada is not doing enough to deal with these cases. And they're always mining companies that have received political support. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's two parts to this. The company needs to be held to account. The victims, of course, need access to remedy for the harm that they've endured. But the Canadian government also needs to step up.
Let's talk briefly about Barrick itself. So the CEO is Mark Bristow. He's a South African. He's been very vocal about how he and really aggressive in purchasing mines in Africa. He is all about expanding Barrick's presence all over the continent in Africa. I think they recently bought out another company that's entire portfolio is in Africa. Barrick has come out swinging, saying, we don't, you know, the police is a Tanzanian matter. We have nothing to do with this, which I know, maybe you could speak to that first. I mean, Barrick's bottom line is, if you're upset about police conduct, talk to the Tanzanian government. So could you just speak to that briefly?
Yeah, that is so disappointing, and so much the response that we get from Barrick. Generally, it's deflecting blame and it's denial. In this case, the police are actually guarding that mine. So they have a contract with the company. They are receiving bonus payments. They're receiving equipment, housing. The chain of command is through the police, but it's also integrated into the mine security more broadly. So the police are there to protect and guard that mine on behalf of Barrick and the company that runs the mine. So, you know, they can make that argument. They can say, well, these are police. But if they didn't want the police there, they could say, we don't want you there because this is private property. They allow the police in on mine property and they call them in. And they actually, there's financial arrangements between the mine and the police, and there's contractual arrangements between the mine and the police. So this is not an arm's length. This is not arm's length. You know, Barrick is directly implicated in what the police are doing at that mine site.
Is there any evidence at all that you're aware of that when a company like Barrick is taken to court, that it tends to rein in the worst of their behavior on site because they're aware that there are eyes on them?
You know, it's becoming hard to believe that that's the case. Like, that's what I would have thought. I would have thought, you know, that especially these serial lawsuits that they're litigating now in England and now in Canada, that this would make a difference. But like I said, there was another killing just November 30th. You know, the company has shown no indication of actually taking it, the fact that people are dying and being maimed for life. And these are poor people. These are, you know, really marginal communities that have become more marginal because of the mine, right? So these are people who are really quite desperate to eke out a living and taking great chances by going into these waste rock dumps. But it's a sign of how impoverished they are and how marginal they are that they're taking these chances to go into the waste rock dumps knowing, because, you know, there's been so many shootings and so many beatings, knowing that that's a possible outcome. And the company knows this. And yet the company seems to treat all of this as business as usual, as just the cost of doing business. You shoot people, you beat people, or you let your security arrangements shoot and beat people. And then if it comes to it, you go to court and you litigate it. But they don't change the practices on the ground. They don't actually change the security arrangements around the mine. They continue on with the same security arrangements. So it's hard to see how Barrick is taking human rights or human life at all seriously.
Mm-hmm. You and I for years have talked about the Canadian Ombudsperson. I guess her official title is Canadian Ombudsperson for Responsible Enterprise, Sherry Meyerhofer. Where is she in all of this?
she's not in any of this, and she would probably be the last place that a case would be brought on these issues. So the company should be dealing with these issues through its own grievance mechanism at the mine site, but that is not functioning. After that, people could go to other non-judicial grievance mechanisms in Canada, such as the CORE, the Ombudsperson that you just mentioned, or our national contact point. Both of these offices are not equipped to actually deal with these kinds of cases. So Sherry Meyerhofer has no powers to compel evidence or compel documents. And that would be necessary in these cases. You'd have to be able to compel CCTV footage, for example, or compel witness testimony from the company itself, or compel evidence from the security arrangements in the company so that you can actually see how the security arrangements are handled within the company. She can't do that. Mm-hmm. The ombudsperson cannot do that. So, you know, it would be a he said, she said, and what's the point of that, right? That really doesn't get you anywhere. The company will say, no, it's all the same arrangements, the same arguments they're already making, right? It's all in the hands of the police. The police are in the hands of the Tanzanian government. Don't talk to us. In court, that will be different. There will be the possibility to compel evidence, and that's really critical here.
Yeah. Okay, so let's just end. Let's bring it back to Tanzania and the Kuria. Catherine, this has just been such a long struggle for them and so unbelievably difficult. We haven't even talked about the land dispossession that's going on and all the rest of it. We talked about that a few weeks ago. But so, you know, I just imagine that this community must be so drained from taking on this Goliath constantly to thus far very little effect. Do you have a sense if this court case, it's a pretty courageous stand for them to now move to this level in taking on Barrick. Is there any sense that this has kind of brought a new galvanization to the community in its fight with Barrick? Or, you know, any kind of symbolic value just back home in terms of what this represents?
Well, it is important. I mean, one thing that we noticed when we did our field work in September of this year, so we were back in the communities in September, one thing we noticed that people are aware of these lawsuits. So this case in Canada had not yet been filed, but people were aware of the two lawsuits that had happened in the UK, and were aware that this was now an option. And I think that's really important, because the only way these lawsuits can, you know, be effective is if people can find their way into these lawsuits. And the case that's been filed is not necessarily only going to be on behalf of the plaintiffs that have been filed now. Plaintiffs can still be added. Mm-hmm. So people are aware that this case is happening now in the communities since it's been filed. And the word spreads very quickly that another case has been filed and that people now have someplace to go with their grievance. So that at least is critically important, because people have access to remedy, which they didn't have before. Now, this is only for the cases of abuse by mine security, for people who, for example, are trying to find rocks in the waste rock dumps. There's another whole area that you just mentioned that is going on right now, where people are being forcibly evicted from their land. And that's also being done very violently. And we haven't talked about that this time. We've talked about it in the past. But in my communications with Barrick on that issue, and Barrick has written back to me now on that, we're finding the same response as denial, just mm-hmm. denial, rather than saying, my gosh, you're raising really serious concerns. We want to, you know, talk to you about this, or we want to actually investigate this. The first response is just denial. And so, you know, people now have an avenue to bring the cases of excess use of force by mine security and police, but they don't yet have a way to deal with the fact that they're being forced off their land to enable the mine to expand.
Okay, well, something tells me we'll be talking again soon, but thank you so much for bringing us up to speed on this lawsuit. I think it's encouraging, and it'll be really interesting to see where this goes.
Thank you so much for your continued interest in this case.
Thanks, Catherine. Take care.
Take care.
You've been listening to an interview with Catherine Koomans, Research Coordinator at Mining Watch Canada. We're going to take a little musical break, and then when we're back, we will be back with Sama and her interview with Dr. Evan Kariga.
fifth conference of the parties, COP15, to the United Nations Convention of Biological Diversity is an international meeting bringing together governments from around the world. Participants will set out new goals and develop an action plan for nature over the next decade. The conference will be held in Montreal, Quebec, the seat of the UN Convention on Biological Diversity Secretariat, from December 7 to 19, 2022. The Convention on Biological Diversity was first signed by 150 government leaders at the 1992 Rio de Janeiro Earth Summit in Brazil. Its main objectives are bringing together countries to agree on targets to ensure the survival of species and stem the collapse of ecosystems across the world. The Convention on Biological Diversity recognizes that biological diversity is about more than plants, animals, and microorganisms and their ecosystems. It is about people and our need for food security, medicines, fresh air and water, shelter, and a clean and healthy environment in which to live. The Convention on Biological Diversity Secretariat is located in Montreal, Quebec. The attendees at COP15 are representatives of governments or observer organizations like charities. The United Nations manages all attendees at any of the COPs. The 197 parties to the United Nations COP are broadly organized in the following regional groups: African region, region of the Americas, Eastern Mediterranean region, including Pakistan, European region, Southeast Asia region, including Thailand, Western Pacific region, including Australia. We will speak with Dr. Evan Kirija, whose research focuses on the intersection of biodiversity and livelihood of indigenous communities in Kenya, more precisely in the vicinity of the Masai Mara National Reserve, an iconic tourist location for wildlife lovers. Dr. Kirija is presently affiliated with Concordia University at the Department of Anthropology. Welcome to our show, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I will quote from your research this paragraph that really impressed me. Having grown up and spent many years in the countryside of the Kenyan highlights, the tranquility and freshness of Oder Kisa was not new to me, but it was still ethereally different in its patterns of life that were now on display to my anthropological gaze. So please share with our listeners your view as an anthropologist now and as a specialist in Kenya.
Right. Yeah. Thank you again for inviting me here and starting with that quote from my dissertation, which I hope to transform into a book in the coming months. Yeah. So my research was conducted in a place called Oldrekesi, which is a Maasai area in south of Kenya, in a county called Narok County. And when I went there, this part that you read actually comes from my experience as a kid trained in Oldrekesi. So Oldrekesi is a semi-arid area, which means it doesn't receive a lot of rainfall, and therefore most of the year it's dry.
What you describe here between the contrast of the two seasons is very poetic, so I'm very pleased to hear more about it.
Right. So when I arrived in Oldrekesi, it was quite dry, and I remember driving there, and basically even the motorcycle left us out of that. And I looked at the animals, they were quite skinny at the time, their grass was brown. And then after a week or so, the rain came, and all of a sudden, everything started turning green. And I took some photos to just compare and contrast the how the two situations compare to each other, and you are vastly different. You could even think you're in a totally different place. But just because the rain has come, everything turned green, livestock had enough grass to eat, and over the next month, things changes, you know, cows and goats and sheep start fighting up, and everything, all life becomes more lively as you go. So that was quite interesting for me, and quite vivid that I thought I would represent it in this way in my dissertation.
I have noticed that all studies about conservation of biodiversity start with a look at the land, who owns it, who inhabits it, how is it shared between different species. And here I'm including, of course, humans, animals, crops, and others. So please tell us briefly, how is land allocated to inhabitants after the colonial era ended in Kenya?
Right. Yeah, so to build on the season and then to the land. So land really is what governs or where everything converges. And with land, I don't just mean the soil, but also the water. Because as we've seen with the rain, when it rains, things change. It means that the soil now becomes more productive, and crops can grow, livestock and wild animals can have food to eat. So land becomes central to what is happening on the land. And then the next question or issue becomes, how are these life ways or ways of living, whether it's for human, wildlife, livestock, are governed in different spaces? And in a space like Old Rikesi, which is inhabited by humans, livestock, and wildlife mainly, and of course other tree species or plant species, then it's interesting to see how, you know, that space is governed to ensure that wildlife have their space and humans have their space where they can coexist with wildlife. Sometimes it doesn't work that way, and, you know, you end up with human-wildlife conflict when sometimes wildlife comes out of the areas that are in theory designated for wildlife conservation and come into areas that are occupied by humans. And just for clarity here, so when you have conserved areas or areas that are designated as wildlife conservation areas, those are usually restricted. Human presence there is restricted, but wildlife is not restricted there. The wildlife is free to, you know, come and occupy spaces that's usually occupied by humans. And quite often, that's where human-wildlife conflicts occur.
We're going to precisely talk about that, because many observers postulate that the biggest challenge to wildlife conservation is land use change over time, which has accelerated human-wildlife conflict, as you mentioned, and also decline in wildlife numbers, especially in areas where crop cultivation has spread. So I'd like you to continue with your comments about this conflict.
Yeah, that's indeed the case. And there have been quite some studies that have showed or found that there are notable shifts from pastoralism to cultivation, or what some have called agropastoralism, which means basically combining cultivation, crop cultivation, or cultivation agriculture with livestock keeping. Not saying that crop cultivation is overtaking pastoralism, but that pastoralists are also now engaging in crop cultivation. And this land use change has indeed been a cause of human wildlife conflict, because wildlife will come to spaces that are occupied by humans and feed on crops that have been cultivated, and as humans try to protect those spaces that have crops that they have cultivated for their own subsistence, then conflict ensue. But I am hesitant to quickly, you know, like just, you know, talk about land use change as a category that's so defined, because I think there's a larger story, a more complex story to what has been termed loosely or even quite easily as land use change. What do we say with, for example, the change towards cultivation? Some arguments have been that, you know, some pastoralists have realized that keeping livestock is not enough as a means of income and as a means of livelihood. So cultivation becomes a way of diversifying their livelihood, so that they can have more food to eat, they can have more sources of income. And So we have to ask the question, why does livestock keeping, which is actually a more an activity that is more harmonious with wildlife conservation, becoming less sufficient to satisfy the needs and demands of livestock or pastoral communities? And one of these we find is that there's been this tendency in Kenya and other African countries that pastoralism is a traditional way of life, and therefore the modern way of life is moving towards crop cultivation. So this has meant that support for pastoral communities has not been as much as support that has been given by government to crop crop farmers. So you find that then it makes sense that people tend towards cultivation and moving away from livestock keeping, which is more difficult. But also, the demands, the everyday life demands have become or converged more on the financial needs. And crop cultivation has become an easier way of getting your finances together. And it becomes lucrative.
Right. We're going to talk about that in a minute, the economic side of it. But this being the case, what is the solution for wildlife conservancy? We're very much interested now in biodiversity and maintaining wildlife. So how would this fit with the situation you're describing, as it is not as lucrative as other endeavors that we will cover in a little while? But I want to hear you on this particular topic of how do we conserve biodiversity?
Yes, indeed. So, interestingly, our studies and many researchers who have done ethnographic work, meaning who have spent quite a long time in the field studying pastoralism, have most of them concur that actually pastoralism is the most harmonious way of life for people inhabiting areas that also have high numbers of wildlife and that are rich in biodiversity, like the Maasai rangelands of Kenya. The pressures on pastoralism, however, are the ones that are driving what you might call biodiversity conservation, or bringing, making it difficult to pursue biodiversity conservation, because there is not a lot of support for the activities that are meant to conserve biodiversity. So wildlife conservancy, which are basically can be simply defined as areas that are set aside for purposes of wildlife conservation and to an extent biodiversity conservation. How can they now create a space where we can realize more biodiversity conservation? So I think one of the ways is incorporating or including communities that inhabit those areas, rather than operating as purely wildlife conservation areas that criminalize or restrict human occupation or human presence in these areas. They should work with communities to find ways that both human livestock and wildlife lives are valued, and establish mechanisms that ensure that human-wildlife relations are not made to be competing for each other, but actually are relations that can be rehabilitated and cultivated in ways that keeping wildlife is not seen as a threat to keeping livestock, for example. And I think this is a way of life that I think pastoral communities have shown that it's capable, but it's the ways in which the state and other conservation or tourism organizations have gone about it is that they have emphasized so much the economic side that they've forgotten about what actually makes biodiversity conservation possible in an area that is inhabited by pastoral communities.
So I will start here with the land that it would be attractive for tourism and just for the safari type, tourism. You mentioned that not all lands are equal in attraction. So what is the feature or the features that you think makes a piece of land more valuable from the tourist point of view?
Yes, this is a very good question, because I would bring in tourism, which is an important component of of an important component of the preserving biodiversity conservation. So tourism, if you think of it, is a business enterprise that is built on attracting people to come and visit these places, and then they pay, and from there visiting those places, they foster economic growth in those places. Then how to create a place that can be considered a tourism site usually goes about, it's built on ideas of wilderness, people wanting to go to the wild and being in a space that's not occupied by people, but rather where people feel like they're connecting with nature and being in a space where you're seeing wildlife. And so the spaces are usually created as tourism hotspots. First of all, have to have high numbers of wildlife. And this is where now wildlife conservancies, national parks, national reserves come in and become demarcated as areas that are purely for tourism activities, and wildlife conservation becoming as a separate activity that is disconnected from communities or people who live there, forgetting that people coexist with wildlife. So tourism then, how can we see tourism in terms of biodiversity conservation? I think the main challenge is that the emphasis on tourism has failed to focus on what makes it possible in the first place. How do you realize biodiversity conservation of safety spaces which have high wildlife numbers? Because we have to remember, if you see a lion, there also has to be the lion, considering a lion as a predator. You also have to have animals like prey, so animals like zebras. And for them to coexist in the same space, usually you have also human influence, which is key to certain species being present. So you find a lot of predators will stay maybe inside the park or conserved areas, but often the prey like zebras will come towards where people are living, and those are dynamics that usually need human intervention for them to function in ways that actually ensure that even the animals that could come to see are there. So for tourism, the emphasis on tourism has overtaken, which I think to be the primary concern, which is biodiversity conservation. And so you find that focusing on tourism means the institutions that are being put in place focus on enhancing tourism as a primary goal, while tourism should be actually the outcome of biodiversity conservation. So if you made biodiversity conservation the primary goal, automatically tourism would flourish. But the fact that we focus so much on the economic side of things, we've left out the primary side of having biodiversity richness in place. And that's why I think tourism currently fails the project of biodiversity conservation in this country.
That's a very interesting point I didn't think of, and it's quite new. Thank you for bringing it up. Now, there's another side of the coin. It's quite disturbing that those who actually own the lands that are open to tourism are from the elite, so what they call elite capture within the tourist business. In your opinion, would it be better if the wildlife lands were owned and serviced by the government for a fairer distribution of income?
That's an interesting proposal. I think if I went to Ulrike and give that proposal to the Maasai who own the land around the Maasai Mara National Reserve, which the land is usually function is a dispersal places for wildlife, meaning that the places that are usually occupied by wildlife are together with the park. I don't think they would agree, because one of the things we the Kenyan state and the cities is many African states. And I'll listen to Achille Mbembe's, who's been main kind of Africanist scholar of the African state, that the African state, post-colonial state, I should emphasize, has institutions that often tend to extract from its people. And so the revenues that are generated by the state become property or riches or wealth of those who are working as state or the public officials or public servants. So often if you would anticipate that there's not enough space that the Kenyan government would actually be the fair kind of decision contributor of revenues that are going from tourism or biodiversity conservation efforts. And this is why we've seen a lot of efforts towards devolving these responsibilities to communities so that communities can have more power, more say in decision making, in the way that revenues are used, and the wildlife conservancies that have been stated are being seen as a way of actually involving communities or making conservation more community-led, more community-driven. It's not there yet. There are a few cases of wildlife conservancies that have involved local communities much more. And it's not a surprise that those wildlife conservancies have experienced more success, even during the, for instance, when there was less tourism activity, like during COVID-19 time. We find that these wildlife conservancies were still doing well and collaborating with local communities, providing food aid. And you see there is a productive working relationship between the wildlife conservancy and the local people. And the attitudes that are, towards wildlife are more friendly from those communities because now they don't see wildlife as a threat, but they see wildlife as an opportunity for them to flourish, but also as a life that has to be respected. So creating this respectful human-wildlife relations, and because they see they are both benefiting from each other by being occupying the same space. So I think the state, the Kenyan state, what it needs is to empower local communities to build these strong institutions of conserving wildlife, because what usually happens with the state when it controls wildlife, as we've seen in the past, they create what some scholars have called fortress conservation. So fortress is a space that restricts human presence and criminalizes human presence, and this means that the local people's ways of life are criminalized, and that creates a lot of discomfort, a lot of injustice,
I would say, injustice.
Between local communities and, unjust relationships between local communities and wildlife, where they feel that wildlife is being protected by the state and local livelihoods are not being protected by the state. So when you see wildlife, it almost feels like you think the state that's actually working against the local community. But when you have local communities in power and being able to control what happens in their spaces and benefiting from the revenues that are garnered from tourism activities, then you see that they're developing more harmonious relationships between the local communities, and we actually are realizing more biodiversity conservation as a result.
Very briefly, Dr. Kurigia, let me ask you, what do you think the international community should be doing to preserve wildlife in Kenya?
Right. So I think wildlife in Kenya, people, will say it's national heritage, but I would like to go a step further and say it's global heritage. So it's for benefit of all of us, as we know now, on a shared planet. So I think the global community has the responsibility of supporting indigenous communities, not just in Kenya, but across the world, including Haiti, Canada, for example, so that the ways of life of local of indigenous communities which have been responsible for the conservation of a lot of biodiversity in the world are supported so that they, and we can learn from them, and we can support them to continue, living that in those kinds of respectful and productive relations that ensure biodiversity conservation, which is what we're working towards, especially in this era of climate change, where we're faced with a global crisis of climate change. So I think the global community, whether it's through certain models of finance support, but also creating other opportunities, such as public services to these communities, is some of the ways in which the international community can support indigenous communities and also biodiversity conservation that has global citizens.
Dr. Ivan Kirishia, thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Our commentary today is about FIFA, the semifinals 2022, Morocco has just become the first African team to qualify for a World Cup semi-final. The scenes of jubilation across Africa and the Arab world are a sight to behold. Afro-Arab relations are shaky at the best of times, but Morocco's victory has united peoples north, south, and east of the Sahara. This is a World Cup unlike others before, taking place in a crystallized, multipolar firmament. Only one team in the top four belongs properly to, quote, the West. Croatia is a peripheral country in the Balkans, and Argentina is from South America.
The realignment is taking shape not only geopolitically. The polarizing debate over whether a World Cup can, in good conscience, be held in a country like Qatar mostly expresses a revolt against the West's cultural hegemony. Speeches on the rights of migrant workers, women's rights, and LGBTQ rights ring hollow for an audience exhausted by the West's double standards. This is itself playing out in the widespread show of Palestinian solidarity.
Amid celebrations of Morocco's advance and applause for its players, display of Palestinian flags, solidarity for the Sahrawi people under Morocco's kingdom, stranglehold was mostly absent.
We can be happy for the Moroccan people and rejoice with the millions across the global south whose hopes and aspirations are now carried by the Atlas Lions.
But we must also be consistent. When the celebrations are over, any serious commitment to struggles for self-determination demands that we keep the Sahrawi cause alive. And this is an opening to do just that. The terrain is not perfect and the contradictions are stark. Even so, in a climate of despair, the World Cup has given ordinary people the ability to dream again. This was from Africa is a Country, penned by Will Shoki, deputy editor.
Folks, that's it for Amanda this week. We have been happy to be here with such a high in Morocco, riding such a wave of enthusiasm and support from around the world. They have managed to defeat three colonial masters already, Belgium, Spain, and Portugal, and to a lesser degree, Canada. We were a colonial master, but we got beat too by them. And there they are now facing France.
Well, by now, our listeners know the results. We don't.
That's it. And so we're so proud of them to have come this far. Whichever result they got today's game, we couldn't forecast it before we broadcast tonight. But we are so proud of Morocco. And so, ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned for Jazz Euphorium.
جلست حدايا ها شحال توحشك يلي كنتي لي مرايا وشحال بكي.